قد شبن بستر كهي والريوان دا تبنتنا
WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. I'm Stephanie Coachman, and this is your WSLR News for Wednesday, July 29th. Almost everybody in Manatee County seems to agree on land preservation. The county commissioners yesterday voted unanimously to put a question on the ballot in November to raise a tax for environmental land purchases. If a simple majority of voters approve on November 3rd, the county will be able to borrow another $75 million to buy land and raise an additional ad valorem tax. In 2020, a similar referendum passed with 71% of the vote. Since then, the county's environmental lands program bought more than 300 acres, expanded 4 preserves, and created 2. The new tax would cost about $47 a year for a home valued at $300,000. In Bradenton, questions continue following the partial roof collapse at a nursing home. According to ABC7, building records show the collapse was the latest in a series of issues documented at the facility over the years. 150 residents were evacuated after part of the roof gave way, and officials continue investigating what caused the failure. State regulators and local authorities are reviewing the facility's history as part of that investigation. The investor-owned utility covering Tampa is looking at a neighboring county to build a solar farm on agricultural land. Tampa Electric is planning a solar farm in eastern Manatee County that will generate enough renewable electricity to power tens of thousands of homes. The project is part of a broader effort to expand clean energy while meeting the region's increasing demand for electricity. These efforts are planned to be established on 400 leased acres of a potato farm in Parrish. And finally, a reminder for Sarasota County voters. If you'd like to vote by mail in the August 18th primary election, your request must be received by 5 p.m. on Thursday, August 6th. Supervisor of Elections Ron Turner is encouraging voters to submit their requests early rather than waiting until the deadline. Requests can be made online, by phone, or in person at any Sarasota County Elections office, helping ensure your ballot arrives with plenty of time to be counted. Until next time, stay informed, stay grounded, and stay engaged. I'm Stephanie Coachman, and this has been your WSLR News.
Welcome to the Peace and Justice Report. My name is Bob Connors. And the opinions you hear today are strictly those of the host and the guest and do not necessarily reflect those of the management team, the board of directors, or any of the volunteers affiliated with the station. I recorded the show today. I came across a podcast by John Deere, Reverend John Deere, who's been in Sarasota a couple of times, a leading peace activist, and I had pulled up a couple of his podcasts, and there was one in particular that I thought I would play today, and that's on Daniel Berrigan. John Deere and Daniel Berrigan were best of friends, and John knew Daniel for many, many, many years, and he was a major influence on John's life. But before I play that recording, John Deere talking about Daniel Berrigan, I'd like to tell you a little bit about John Deere. This is a bio off of his website, johndeere.org. And it goes like this. The life of peace is both an inner journey toward the disarmed heart and a public journey toward a disarmed world. Reverend John Deere writes in his book, Living Peace, This difficult but beautiful journey gives infinite meaning and fulfillment to life itself because our lives become a gift for the whole human race. With peace as the beginning, middle, and end of life, life makes sense. Reverend John Deere is one of the most well-known teachers and voices for peace and nonviolence in the world. In 2008, Archbishop Desmond Tutu nominated him for the Nobel Peace Prize, saying, "John Deere is the embodiment of a peacemaker. He is led by example through his actions and in his writings and in numerous sermons, speeches, and demonstrations. He believes that peace is not something static, but rather to make peace is to be engaged mind, body, and spirit. His teaching is to love yourself, to love your neighbor, your enemy, and to love the world, and to understand the profound responsibility in doing all of these. He is a man who has the courage of his convictions and who speaks out and acts against war, the manufacture of weapons, and any situation where a human being might be at risk through violence." Archbishop Tutu continued, "For evil to prevail requires only that good people sit on the sidelines and do nothing. John Deere is compelling all of us to stand up and take responsibility for the suffering of humanity, so often caused through selfishness and greed." John was born on August 13, 1959, attended Duke University, and entered the Society of Jesus in August 1982. Shortly before entering the Jesuits, he traveled through Israel during Israel's war on Lebanon. While camping out at the Sea of Galilee and in visiting the Chapel of the Beatitudes, he witnessed Israeli warplanes swoop down over the sea and drop bombs a few miles away at the Lebanon border. He decided then and there to spend his life working for peace and disarmament and teaching the Beatitudes and the Sermon on the Mount. He plunged himself into the peace movement and in 1985 lived and worked in a refugee camp in El Salvador during the Civil War under the direction of Jesuit Refugee Service and the Jesuits, who were later assassinated in 1989. Over the years, he ran a homeless shelter in Washington, D.C., taught at Jesuit High School and at Fordham University, and received two master's degrees in theology at the Graduate Theological Union in California, and was ordained in June 1993. In the 1990s, he arranged for Mother Teresa to speak to various governors to stop the death penalty and help prevent 8 executions. He directed a large community center for African American women and children in Richmond, Virginia for several years, then lived in Belfast, Northern Ireland for the Jesuit sabbatical year, working in a human rights center. In 1998, he became executive director of the Fellowship of Reconciliation, the largest interfaith peace organization in the United States, and led Nobel laureates to Iraq, an interfaith delegation to Israel and Palestine, and the People's Campaign for Nonviolence, 40 Days of Teaching and Actions in Washington, D.C. in 2000. In September 11, 2011, he served as the Red Cross Coordinator of Chaplains at the Family Assistance Center and counseled thousands of relatives and rescue workers there and at Ground Zero, while also organizing demonstrations in Times Square and elsewhere against the U.S. war in Afghanistan. He has organized hundreds of demonstrations against war and injustice and has been arrested about 85 times for nonviolent civil disobedience. In December 1993, he was arrested for hammering on an F-15 nuclear-capable fighter bomber in Goldsboro, North Carolina, for a plowshares disarmament action. He faced 20 years in prison and spent 9 months in jail and 2 years under house arrest. After his 9/11 work, he moved to New Mexico in 2002, became pastor of several churches in the impoverished high desert. He then began an annual vigil for disarmament outside the nuclear weapons national laboratories in Los Alamos, New Mexico, birthplace of the atomic bomb, which was held every August for 20 years. On August 6, 1995, he organized a national commemoration of the 50th anniversary of Hiroshima, attended by over 2,000 people at the National Cathedral in D.C. In 2013, along with actor Martin Sheen, he gave the opening keynote talk in Oslo, Norway, at the launch of the ICAN, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, and their UN movement to abolish nuclear weapons along humanitarian grounds, which won the 2017 Nobel Peace Prize. In August 2020, the 75th anniversary of Nagasaki and Hiroshima, he organized and hosted a national Zoom workshop on nuclear weapons disarmament, which featured Archbishop Wester of New Mexico, Dr. Ira Helfand of the Nobel Group's Physicians for Social Responsibility, and the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. In 2016, he left the Jesuits and joined the Diocese of Monterey, California, where he currently resides. He participated in the April 2016 Vatican Conference on Nonviolence in Rome and was asked by Cardinal Turkson to draft Pope Francis's January 1st, 2017 World Day of Peace message. The first day statement on nonviolence and the history of the Catholic Church. He joined the staff of Passe I Bene and co-founded Campaign Nonviolence, a national week of action every September in the USA around International Peace Day, September 21st, which has grown to include 4,000 actions across the U.S. and every state against war, poverty, racism, nuclear weapons, and environmental destruction. He has been featured in the New York Times, the Washington Post, USA Today, The Sun, National Public Radio's All Things Considered, and elsewhere. For 8 years, he wrote a weekly column for the National Catholic Reporter and Huffington Post and is featured regularly on the national radio show Democracy Now! He's the subject of the DVD documentary The Narrow Path, with music by Joan Baez and Jackson Brown, and is profiled in John Deere on Peace by Patty Nomalai. He is the author of hundreds of articles on peace and nonviolence and over 40 books, including The Beatitudes of Peace, Praise Be Peace, They Will Inherit the Earth, Living Peace, The Nonviolent Life, Radical Prayers, The God of Peace, Seeds of Nonviolence, and many others. He has edited books about Daniel Berrigan, Mahatma Gandhi, Marie Maguire, and many others. He is the literary executive of Daniel Berrigan and chairs the Daniel Berrigan Literary Trust, and on the National Advisory Boards of Veterans for Peace and the annual Selma March. His active nonviolence offers you and me a way out of the world's mad violence and a way forward into the light and life of God's peace. Deere writes in his book, The Nonviolent Life, and invites us to reject violence once and for all. It suggests that we no longer need to nurture violence within us or manifest violence towards others, or treat animals and the earth violently, or remain powerless in the face of the world's systemic injustice, war-making, nuclear weapons, and destructive policies. We have a power at our disposal, a weapon of love and truth that we all are still just learning. With nonviolence, as Gandhi and King insisted, the days of violence are coming to an end, John writes. With every choice and action for nonviolence, we begin a new era in human history. This new age will be rooted in the best of spirituality, theology, and morality. The best in all of us for all of us. As we deepen nonviolence in every aspect of life, we herald the coming of a nonviolent world. A world without war, racism, hunger, killings, executions, nuclear weapons, or environmental destruction. There can be no better use of our lives. Along the way, we fulfill a calling to become sons and daughters of the God of Peace. Well, that's a bio of John Deere that you can find on johndeere.org. It's pretty much his whole bio on that site. So with that being said, he conducted a podcast, and he talked about Daniel Berrigan on the 10th year of his death. He lived to be 95, and he died in 2016. Before we go to that, I just want to let you know you're listening to your own community radio station right here, WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, WBPV 100.1 LPFM. So I'm going to play you that recording now. John Deere commemorating the 10th anniversary of Daniel Berrigan's death and commemorating his life. John Deere on Daniel Berrigan.
Today I'd like to reflect on the life and work and teachings of my friend and mentor, the legendary peacemaker and war resister, Reverend Daniel Berrigan. Dan was born in 1921. He was a Jesuit priest, poet, author of 50 books, lecturer, anti-war activist, arrested some 200 to 300 times in protests, who died 10 years ago on April 30th, 2016, just before his 95th birthday. A few years before he died, a friend took him to a recording studio where he recorded some of his poems. So let's start with Dan himself, here giving some opening remarks on the CD and then reading his poem, The Trouble with Our State.
Well, you begin this reading with an essay of William Carlos Williams on war. And specifically, he was writing about the Second World War, which, of course, was supposed to be a great and virtuous undertaking. His essay is dated, quote, now, 1941. And I'll quote a little and then go on with a poem. He writes, quote, one of the purposes of the death, and he capitalizes the word death, as though it were, I don't know, divine or something, or quasi-demonic. One of the purposes of the death among us is to terrify the world, to push our culture so far back that it will take a full generation, another crop of flesh and mind, before we can begin to regenerate. Then another war will be upon us to drive the mind from its advances, and this shuttle to go on in perpetuity. We are never to be allowed to catch up, to regain equilibrium for a permanent arrest of the destroyer. And he capitalizes destroyer. This is called The Trouble with Our State. The trouble with our state was not civil disobedience, which in any case was hesitant and rare. Civil disobedience was rare as kidney stone. No, rarer. It was disappearing, like immigrants' disease. You've heard of a war on cancer. There is no war like the plague of media. There is no war like routine. There is no war like three square meals. There is no war like a prevailing wind. It blows softly, whispers, don't rock the boat. The sails obey. The ship of state rolls on. The trouble with our state, we learned it only afterward when the dead resembled the living who resembled the dead, and civic virtue shone like paint on tin, and tin citizens and tin soldiers marched to the common whip. Our trouble, the trouble with our state of soul, with our state of siege, was civil obedience.
Well, that was classic Daniel Berrigan. What I'd like to do is talk a little bit about his two great actions, the Catonsville Nine and the Plowshares Eight, and then go through some of the basic lessons I learned from him over 40 years, and along the way we'll hear a couple more of his poems. By the 1960s, I hope, as you all know, Dan was a prominent priest, poet, and author. He was one of the best friends of Thomas Merton and Dorothy Day, and with his brother Philip Berrigan was a nationally known activist. By 1964, they were already speaking out against the Vietnam War. And then in 1967, on October 22nd, there was a massive mobilization on the Pentagon, the first big march ever. And Dan brought a busload of Cornell students down to D.C. for the protest. And they all marched forward to face arrest, so he spontaneously joined them, and they were held for 2 weeks. He was the first priest in U.S. history arrested in the cause of justice and peace. Then, a few months later, in February 1968, Dan traveled to North Vietnam with Howard Zinn to bring back three U.S. prisoners of war. And while they were there, it was global news, the U.S. bombed Hanoi right on the block where they were. So they hid out in a shelter for a full week as the U.S. bombs fell around him. So that was partly why, then, on May 17th, 1968, a month after the killing of Dr. King, Dan joined his brother Philip Berrigan and seven others, and they walked into a draft board house in little Catonsville, Maryland, outside of Baltimore. They just walked right in, up the stairs. They took 300 draft files, put them in their hands. They walked out to the parking lot. They had all the press there waiting, and they poured homemade napalm on the draft records and lit them and said the Lord's Prayer. Their action was instantly national news, just massive press coverage really around the world, and it eventually led to 300 other similar draft board raids and demonstrations, which many have argued systematically helped end the draft and hasten the end of the Vietnam War. Now, think about it. This is way before computers. So all a person had was a typewritten record. So if you destroy the record, the records, the paperwork of the draft, and it was done throughout the whole northeast of the country, thousands of young men could not be drafted and sent to Vietnam. And no one talks about the historic effort these actions had and how they inspired millions and millions of students to march against the war. But at the event, Dan wrote this amazing statement, which is one of the greatest in U.S. resistance literature. So I'll read this. "Our apologies, good friends, for the fracture of good order, for the burning of paper instead of children, the angering of the orderlies in the front parlor of their charnel house. We could not, so help us God, do otherwise. We say killing is disorder. Life and gentleness and community and unselfishness are the only order we recognize. For the sake of that order, we risk our liberty, our good name. The time is past when good men and women can remain silent, when obedience can segregate men and women from public risk, when the poor can die without defense. We ask our fellow Christians to consider in their hearts a question which has tortured us night and day since the war began. How many must die before our voices are heard? How many must be tortured, dislocated, starved, maddened? How long must the world's resources be raped in the service of legalized murder? When, at what point, will you say no to this war? We have chosen to say, with the gift of our liberty, if necessary, our lives, the violence stops here, the death stops here, the suppression of the truth stops here, this war stops here." That statement, which I find so profound, had a huge impact on millions of people. And that October 1968, they were put on trial in Baltimore. 10,000 people marched to the courthouse for it. They, of course, were found guilty, and while Dan was awaiting prison, he wrote a play, The Trial of the Catonsville Nine, which continues to be performed around the world to this day. But the war worsened, and instead of turning himself into prison as he was supposed to in April 1970, Dan went underground. And for many, many months, he traveled the country, evading over 100 FBI agents who were searching for him. And he appeared almost every day in the national media, whether on the front page of the New York Times or in the evening news. And he wrote many articles, and he was infuriating, we now know, J. Edgar Hoover and his henchmen. One Sunday, he even appeared in a Philadelphia church to give the sermon, which is very well known, because he said, it began by saying something like, "We have chosen, like Jesus, to be powerless criminals in a time of criminal power." That's kind of classic Dan. That August 1970, he was arrested in Block Island, Rhode Island, and sent to Danbury Prison, where he barely survived the next few years. One of the things he wrote during that time while he was underground was an open letter in the Village Voice to the Weathermen, which was the group that was protesting the war by using violence. And he asked them to reconsider their violence and to stop blowing up buildings in opposition to the war, and instead to use the tactic of nonviolence. So here's a sentence that's in that article that Dan wrote. "The death of a single human being is too heavy a price to pay for the vindication of any principle, however sacred." To me, that is one of his most important statements. It's a modern translation of the gospel. In other words, he's saying there's no cause, however noble, for which we will ever again support the taking of a single human life, even for the cause of trying to stop the killing. We do not kill people. We do not support killing. We do not kill people who kill people to show that killing people is wrong. We give our lives to stop the killing. But we don't use violence or kill others. So we don't join the U.S. military. We will not send our kids into the military. We urge young people to quit the military. We will not work for the weapons industry or build nuclear weapons. And we will not let our churches support war. And we will resist war for the rest of our lives. So after the Berrigans got out of prison in the 1970s, they just kept at it. And even though the media turned away from them, they turned their attention now to nuclear weapons. And they started to study the book of Isaiah, the call to beat swords into plowshares. And so it was on September 9th, 1980, okay, we're at the beginning of the 80s under Reagan, that Dan and Phil Berrigan and six friends walked into the big General Electric headquarters in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania. It's a little town outside of Philadelphia, where they build nuclear weapons, and they just walked right in the door. And you opened a door, and there were nuclear weapons. And they walked over and hammered on these unarmed nuclear weapon nose cones. The Plowshares 8 were arrested, convicted, and faced 10 years in prison. Theirs was the first of over some 100 Plowshare disarmament actions, including the one I later did with Phil in North Carolina in 1993, for which I went to jail and faced 20 years in prison for my action. So I'm telling you this because of the statement Dan said at this famous 1981 Plowshares trial, which always moved me. "The only message I have to the world is we are not allowed to kill innocent people. We are not allowed to be complicit in murder. We are not allowed to be silent while preparations for mass murder proceed in our name, with our money, secretly. It's terrible for me to live in a time where I have nothing to say to human beings except stop killing. There are so many other beautiful things that I would love to be saying to people. There are other projects I could be very helpful at, and I can't do them. I cannot, because everything is endangered. Everything is up for grabs. Ours is a kind of primitive situation, even though we would call ourselves sophisticated. Our plight is very primitive from a Christian point of view. We are back where we started. Thou shalt not kill. We are not allowed to kill. Everything comes down to that. Everything." So that's Daniel Berrigan, and that was around the time I met him. And throughout the 1980s and 90s, he was speaking somewhere in the country every week. He published a steady stream of poetry, essays, journals, and 20 books on the Hebrew prophets, 50 books in all. He served for years as a hospital chaplain in a New York hospital for the poor, and then at St. Vincent's Hospital in New York City, ministering to AIDS patients. He volunteered at the local neighborhood homeless shelter, and he was part of a local peace group that met every other Tuesday night for over 40 years. He was constantly giving retreats and saying mass, and was a leader in our Jesuit community on the Upper West Side. And he was arrested about five times a year from the 1970s until about 2010, and he died peacefully at the Jesuit infirmary at Fordham University in 2016. So here he is reading another one of his poems. This poem is called Prophecy.
Prophecy. The way I see the world is strictly illegal, to wit, through my eyes. It's illegal, yes, to wit. I live like a pickpocket, like the sun, like the hand that writes this. I live by my wits. This is not permitted that I look on the world, and worse, insist that I see what I see, a conundrum, a fury, a burning bush, and with five fingers where my eyes fail that I trace with a blackened brush on butcher sheets, black on white, black for blood, white for death, where the light fails. That I trace that face which is not my own and my own, that death which is not my own and my own. This is strictly illegal and will bring only trouble. As somewhere now in a precinct, in a dock, the statues thrash in fury, hear them, hear ye! The majestic jaws of crocodiles in black shrouds, the laws forbidding me the world, the truth, under blood oath. Forbidding row upon row of razors, of statues, of molars, of grinders, those bloodshot eyes, legal, sleepless, man-eating, not letting me not let blood.
So I've written and talked a lot about Dan, and if you're interested in more, you might like to get my book, Daniel Berrigan, Essential Writings, from Orbis Books, which I edited. I call it Dan's Greatest Hits. But I thought what I'd like to do today in honor of him, as I remember him, is just go through a couple of basic teachings and lessons that I learned from him over some 40 years as my teacher and friend. And so the first, they may seem obvious, but the accumulation of them is overwhelming. So first, I just want to say for the record that Dan was against war and every weapon of violence and talked about it every day of his whole life and insisted that every Christian in the U.S. and the world had to be against war and against every weapon of violence and war, and that we had to talk about it and make the connections between our faith and the good we do, and the reality of this ongoing permanent war in the world. So, for example, connecting the dots between helping, if we're helping the hungry or the homeless or someone who's sick or in prison, and remember that war makes people hungry, homeless, sick, and in prison, and it kills them and vaporizes them. And we're on track to destroy everyone, everywhere. And that this is the ultimate spiritual crisis of idolatry, heresy, blasphemy, hatred. We need to name it and resist it. I heard him say that 100 times. Dorothy Day wrote, "War is the health of the state." Dan said, "War is anti-God, anti-Christ, anti-gospel, anti-life." And each generation is brainwashed all over again to believe in war and the false gods of war, and we go right along with it, and so do the churches. So here's a typical quote from Dan, one of many I could have found. Here goes. "The Bible teaches in many places and warns, denounces, illumines this one bitter truth. The violence of humans is, in essence, genocidal. Mass suicidal. War is not itself until it is total war, claiming the total person, the human family in its entirety, universal life. Such a will in our lifetime creates weapons to match its madness, and for once the weapons are equal to the will. They are as merciless as we are. They at length resemble us, our alter ego. War has thus become the ultimate antichrist, the obscene god of death, condemning all of life to capital punishment. That's the teaching that I heard every day for decades. So secondly, Dan taught that nonviolent resistance to our own country, our own government, our permanent war-making capitalist economy, the whole system of militarism, has to become a permanent way of life for us from now on. That's a very difficult teaching. And this is written in his amazing book, The Dark Night of Resistance, which was written while he was underground in 1970. And this is a quote from page one. A proposition. The state of resistance as a state of life itself. Like it or not, this is the shape of things. We will not again know sweet normalcy in our lifetime. Friends, I read that when I was 21 and just entering the Jesuits and about to meet Dan, and I agreed and I've never looked back. That's what I've tried to do with my life. And I invite everyone to join Dan and me and all of us. And from now on, that's just part of our lives. We resist war, nuclear weapons, the killing of the poor, the destruction of the earth, and all the fallout of warfare. What he called the means and metaphors of death, racism, poverty, mass incarceration, execution, every form of violence. And we do everything we can to end it and to work for a new culture of peace and nonviolence, whether or not we live to see it. So Dan believed in telling the truth, which, as he liked to say, which he said all the time, means saying yes and saying no. Well, he was just citing the Sermon on the Mount there. Let your yes be yes and your no be no. But what he was trying to say is we all have to speak out publicly and say no to war, no to violence, no to racism, no to the death penalty, no to nuclear weapons, no to deporting immigrants, no to corporate greed, no to environmental destruction, and yes, yes to life, yes to peace, yes to nonviolence, yes to justice, yes to racial equality, yes to creation. Here's a quote from Dan. I know that the prophetic vision is not popular today in some spiritual circles, but our task is not to be popular or to be seen as having an impact, but to speak the deepest truths that we know. We need to live our lives in accord with the deepest truths we know, even if doing so does not produce immediate results in the world. So as we remember Dan on the anniversary of his death, we continue to stand up publicly and speak out and say things like, end the U.S. war on Iran, end U.S. backing of the Israeli war on Palestine, Gaza, the West Bank, Lebanon, end U.S. involvement in all the wars in the world, from Ukraine to Congo, Sudan, Yemen, Venezuela, everywhere. Abolish ICE, the death penalty, nuclear weapons, the fossil fuel industry, and poverty. And let's spend those trillions of dollars so that every human being on the planet can have good food, clean water, adequate housing, free health care, education, employment, and yes, dignity and peace. So I heard Dan tell so many of us over and over again a crucial lesson he learned from Gandhi, but personally from Dorothy Day and Thomas Merton. And that's the hard lesson for activists, that you give your life for the work of justice and peace, but at the same time, you let go of the results, of the outcome, even of any expectations of a victory of justice and peace. Even as you give your whole life for justice and disarmament and creation, do the good because it's good, he said, which is a very simple but wise truth. Speak the truth because it's right. Work for peace and justice because that's what God wants. And leave the outcome in God's hands. We're not in charge. God is. The way he wrote it in one of his poems was, the outcome is in better hands than ours. We do what we can, and we offer a gospel witness to the nonviolent Jesus. I think that's very liberating and freeing, the deeper I can go into that. This is related, to my mind, to the old 1960s slogan, don't just stand there, do something, which Dan eventually reversed to, after the Vietnam War, don't just do something, stand there, which later he turned into repeating, know where you stand and stand there. I saw Dan live and practice this radical, almost militant gospel nonviolence in four ways. Contemplative nonviolence, so he spent every day serious quality time in prayer and meditation, over 3 hours of prayerful writing, usually on the scriptures, every day for as long as I knew him. And then he would take a mindfulness walk in Central Park after lunch, and then we'd have mass with the community before dinner. I saw him engage in active nonviolence, and I took direct action and civil disobedience with him over and over again. And I saw him try to do concrete acts of service to those in need. For example, there was a homeless person who lived on our block, and Dan took care of him probably for decades. Prophetic nonviolence. Dan believed in speaking out publicly for justice and peace in every way he could. So he tried all different kinds of things. And that included teaching. He was always teaching in schools and universities and giving lectures and holding retreats, talking to the press, and writing, which he thought as a way of public speaking in books and articles. But like Merton's and Dorothy Day's nonviolence, this would be my fourth point about nonviolence, Dan practiced what I call eschatological nonviolence. That is, he had just this innate, interior, spiritual, long-haul view of things that I rarely encounter among activists. He had a spiritual view. That is, he looked toward the kingdom of God. So he claimed his citizenship in God's reign of peace. He had let go or even left the United States long ago, so it wasn't a big loss to be convicted on felony charges and faced with many years in prison. He was full-time in the kingdom of God. He was totally surrendered and letting God be in control of his life. And that's why, now that I'm older and I look back on my life friendship with him, he had a deep inner peace and contentment and even joy that I could never quite grasp. But I'm beginning to understand it now in his long-term surrender and view. Whenever he had a meal with his friends, he would always ask everyone to go around and talk about their lives. It almost became a ritual for him for 50 years. He was concerned about everyone's life and what we were doing, as Mary Oliver would say, with this gift of this one precious life. He wanted us to spend our lives wisely, and so he was always trying to build community so that we weren't alone. Here's a great question that he posed in The Dark Night of Resistance when he was underground hiding from J. Edgar Hoover. What are we to do with our lives? That's really the question of Daniel Berrigan. He continues, a question which seems to me is a peerless source of freedom to the one who dares pose it with seriousness. Anything short of confronting this question ends up sooner or later in a suffocating dead end. We have taken up one after another almost every question except the one which would liberate us, the question of our humanity. How is a human being to live today? How is he or she to live? Is it possible for a person to do something other than kill his brother or sister? The practically universal demand laid upon us by the state and approved by the silent church? Is there another way to live here and now, which will also allow future generations to live their lives in a different way from the one sanctioned today? In other words, I always heard him asking, what does it mean to be a human being? What are we supposed to do with our lives? Can we become like Gandhi and Dr. King and Dorothy, people of active, creative, contemplative nonviolence? So I met Dan at a retreat center just after I entered the Jesuits in 1982. That first night we stayed up late talking. I was 22 and I was saying, well, I was really scared. It's really great to meet you. It was so full of myself as a young whippersnapper. But I could never do any of this. I can't work for peace and justice. And finally he said to me, it was one of the very first things he ever said to me was, he almost whispered it, what are you afraid of? You don't have to be afraid. You don't have to live in fear. We live in faith and hope and peace. No one ever said that to me. I didn't know that. I had heard Jesus said that, but I didn't know that you could do it. And I decided to give it a try right then and there. And then I later realized we all need a teacher who tells us not to be afraid. It's a very helpful thing to tell others. So here's what he said the next morning, and I wrote it very fast. These are from my original notes. These are his first sentences. So he stands up in the little retreat center and goes, "The world is a kingdom of death, and into this world walks the great yes of God, the Christ, bringing all sorts of trouble, all sorts of dislocations, unmaskings, law breakings, and truth telling. The disarmed God and the disarming of God in Christ is the great scandal of history. We are not yet a disarmed church because we are not yet worshipers of a disarmed God. But God comes to us disarmed in Christ. And Christ does all the wrong things in the wrong places, at the wrong time, with the wrong people. Today, we are asked to live out the drama of the disarmed Christ in a world armed to the teeth. To confess Jesus these days is to work for disarmament, justice, and peace." That was life-changing for me to hear those few sentences. And I remember telling him I never heard anybody talk that way. He was saying, well, if you want to follow Jesus today, that means working publicly for peace and justice. And if you're not working for peace and justice, we could say, whatever, disarmament and creation, a new nonviolent world, you're not following the nonviolent Jesus. So a year or two later, Pax Christi asked me to interview him, and I had the interview, and at the end, I blurted out. I was so nervous. I was a dopey kid, and I wanted to ask him the meaning of life, and I finally just said, so, Dan, what's the point of all this again? And without missing a beat, Dan said, "All you have to do is make your story fit into Jesus' story." That, friends, became a guiding principle for my life. It was the meaning of life for me. And it was a very gentle way of saying it. I think I was scared because he was going to say, "You have to go end all the wars." No. Make your story fit into Jesus' story, which may be harder. A few years later, as I went on over 100 retreats with him, he began a weekend retreat on Friday night. This was his opening sentence. "Well, if you want to follow Jesus, you better look good on wood." That didn't go over very well with most of the people there. Literally, a bunch of young Jesuits got up and left. Over the years, I saw and heard Dan teach the Sermon on the Mount many fresh ways, and I heard him trash the just war theory over and over again, saying it has nothing to do with the gospel or Jesus. Actually, as you know, it's based on Aristotle. But now, with nuclear weapons, you can never meet any of the conditions of the so-called just war theory. It's all baloney. It's all a lie of the empire. And so, thank God, with Pope Francis and Pope Leo, the church is now beginning to reject the just war theory, as there never really was one, and return the church to gospel nonviolence. Even though many theologians and right-wing church commentators refuse to acknowledge this development, it's happening. So here's a favorite quote of mine, which I put in the Essential Writings book of Dan. I found an obscure essay in the early 1980s. So here's Dan. "I was in Europe some time ago speaking on the nuclear question. I came in the wake of an internationally known moral theologian who said, 'The Berrigans are off base. They are talking about the Sermon on the Mount as though it were realizable now. What we really need is an ethic of the interim.'" Wow. So Dan writes, "An ethic of the interim, as I understand it, would allow us to fill the gap between today and tomorrow with all the bodies of all those who must die before we finally accept the word of Christ. On the contrary, I think the Sermon on the Mount concerns us here and now, today, or concerns us never. So in whatever modest and clumsy a way, we are called to honor the preference of Christ for suffering rather than inflicting suffering on others, for dying rather than killing. In that sense, all, quote, interim ethics have been cast aside. The time to obey is now. Wow, that just always gets me. And I like that he says we're called to live the Sermon on the Mount in Christ's preference of nonviolence in whatever modest or clumsy way we can. That's classic Dan, too. Finally, Dan lived as if the resurrection of the nonviolent Jesus was true. That the worst had already happened. That the outcome was indeed in better hands than ours. That death does not get the last word. And that despite the evidence, there is reason for real hope. What he called, this is his phrase, the slight edge of life over death. And all we have to do is go forward, fitting our story into Jesus' story in pursuit, like Jesus, of disarmament and justice, the coming of God's reign of peace on earth. So here's one of my favorite passages. Again, an obscure essay he wrote I found in his papers. This is about the risen Jesus. Once there was a dead man, a criminal, a subject of capital punishment, and lo, he refused to stay dead. He stood up. As the authorities shortly came to sense, this was an earthquake in the nature of law and order, in the nature of death, the nature of war. For in the nature of things, as assigned by the nation state, a great one for deciding what the nature of things is, dead men stay dead. The word from Big Brother is, the word that gives him clout, inspires fear is, a criminal, once disposed of, stays disposed. Not at all. Along come these crazies shouting in public, our guy's not dead. He's risen. Now, I submit you can't have such a word going around and still run the state properly. The first nonviolent revolution was, of course, the resurrection. And the event had to include death as its first act, as well as the command to Peter, put up your sword, so that it might be clear once and for all that Christians suffer death rather than inflict it. I just love his teachings on resurrection. And for Dan, peace work was living in the resurrection or getting ready for resurrection. That's why I define resurrection as having nothing to do with death, having not a trace of violence in you. That's why, to me, resurrection means total nonviolence. And living now in the new life of the risen Christ. I got all this from Dan. Dan knew as I witnessed from him in many, many ways, our survival is already guaranteed. So we don't need to be afraid or violent or discouraged or despairing. We are headed toward resurrection and all its glorious political consequences. So here's what he said at a big conference of Jesuits in 1985, talking about the Plowshares actions and the civil disobedience actions, which most Jesuits hated and were appalled at. Quote, since 1980 and all the Plowshares actions, some of us have continued to labor to break the demonic clutch on our souls of the ethic of Mars, of wars and rumors of wars, inevitable wars, just wars, necessary wars, victorious wars, and we say our no in acts of hope. For us, all these repeated arrests, the interminable jailings, the life of our small communities, the discipline of nonviolence, these have embodied an ethic of resurrection. Simply put, we long to taste that event, its thunders and quakes, its great yes. We want to test the resurrection in our bones, to see if we might live in real hope instead of the thicket of cultural despair, nuclear despair, a world of perpetual war. We want to taste the resurrection. May I say, we have not been disappointed. Wow. That's the invitation of Daniel Berrigan. Let's try to taste the resurrection, to pursue the heights and depths and length and breadth of creative, active gospel nonviolence and universal love. So I was writing all this up and reviewing all my notes over the decades from Dan. And I started for myself just coming up with a short little list. Actually, now it's about 15 items that kind of sum up some of these sayings. Here goes. Try to make your story fit into the story of Jesus. Have nothing to do with death. In other words, do no harm in thought, word, or deed, but be human in an inhuman world, in an inhuman time. Live consciously, I heard him say that. Live life to the full. Be life givers. He told a friend of mine, find a group of friends you can pray with and march with, and you'll be fine. Take risks for peace, even if they go nowhere. Seek first the kingdom of God. In other words, practice this eschatological nonviolence. Know where you stand and stand there. If you want to be hopeful, do hopeful things. We can no longer afford the luxury of despair. Stay close to Jesus in the Gospels, and therefore in the poor, in the broken and sorrowful. Practice resurrection. Seek resurrection. Act as if the resurrection is true. And be peaceful at all times, to all people, in every moment. For Dan, that meant living a Zen life and breathing in the Holy Spirit in mindfulness, compassion, and universal love. But here's something he said to me when I was 22. All you have to do, John, is close your eyes to the culture and open them to your friends. Let go, let go. Surrender into God's hands. Live well and die well. And of course, whenever you're getting ready to go off and get arrested and go to jail, don't forget to bring your toothbrush. If you'd like more info on Daniel Berrigan, visit danielberrigan.org or get some of his 50 books, many of which, as his literary executor, I've had republished at whipandstock.com. You might especially like Daniel Berrigan Essential Writings. Let's end with Dan reading his poem, Some.
The poem is called Some, S-O-M-E, Some. Some stood up once and sat down. Some walked a mile and walked away. Some stood up twice and sat down. I've had it, they said. Some walked 2 miles and walked away. Too much, they cried. Some stood and stood and stood. They were taken for fools, they were taken for being taken in. Some walked and walked and walked. They walked the earth, they walked the waters, they walked the air. Why do you stand, they were asked, and why do you walk? Because of the children, they said, and because of the heart, and because of the bread. Because the cause is the heart's beat, and the children born, and the risen bread.
So thank you, friends, for listening to the Nonviolent Jesus podcast. You can hear more podcasts and find other upcoming Zoom programs at beatitudescenter.org. And there you can sign up to receive our free e-blast with news about other upcoming podcasts and Zooms. Please tell your friends and coworkers about this podcast. Also, I hope you'll get my new book, Universal Love, Surrendering to the God of Peace. If you are on Substack, you can find me at Father John Deere. So may the God of Peace bless you all. Keep on following the Nonviolent Jesus, and see you next time.
Justice.